Thus have I heard on one occasion a Blessed One was living at Kosambi in Gosita's park. Now on that occasion the monks of Kosambi had taken to quarreling and brawling and were in deep disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. You know what that means. Here a certain monk went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, stood at one side and said, Venerable Sir, the monks here at Kosambi have taken to quarreling and brawling and are in deep disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. It would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Blessed One would go to those monks out of compassion. The Blessed One consented in silence. That means he shook his head. Then the Blessed One went to those monks and said, Enough, monks, let there be no quarreling, brawling, and wrangling or dispute. When this was said, a certain monk said to the Blessed One, Wait, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One, the Lord of the Dhamma, live at ease, be devoted to a pleasant abiding here and now. We are the ones who will be responsible for the quarreling, brawling, wrangling, and dispute. I couldn't imagine saying that to the Buddha. It's kind of, get out of here, boy. Go meditate. You don't have to worry about what we're doing. For a second time and a third time, the Blessed One said, Enough, monks, let there be no quarreling, brawling, wrangling, or dispute. For a second and a third time, that monk said to the Blessed One, Wait, Venerable Sir, we are the ones that will be responsible for this quarreling, brawling, wrangling, and dispute. Now, this was right before the rains retreat, and the Buddha had been invited to stay the whole rains retreat in Kosambi. But he didn't want to be hanging out with monks that were full of themselves. So, when it was morning, the Blessed One, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, entered Kosambi for alms. When he'd wandered for alms in Kosambi and had returned from his alms round after the meal, he set his resting place in order, took the bowl and outer robe, and while standing uttered these stanzas. The Buddha never gave a discourse while he was standing. So that shows you some of his displeasure with these monks. When many voices shout at once, none considers himself a fool. Though the Sangha is being split, none thinks himself to be at fault. They've forgotten thoughtful speech. They talk obsessed by words alone. Uncurb their mouths, they brawl at will. None knows what leads them to so act. He abused me, he beat me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who harbor such thoughts as these, hatred will never be appeased. He abused me, he beat me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who do not harbor such thoughts, hatred will always be appeased. For in this world, hatred is never overcome by hatred alone. Hatred is only overcome by loving kindness. This is the fixed law, an ageless law. Those others do not recognize that they should restrain, or we should restrain ourselves. But those wise ones who realize this at once end all their enmity. breakers of bones, murderers, those who steal cattle, horses, wealth, those who pillage an entire realm. When even these can act together, why can you not do so too? If one can find a worthy friend, a virtuous, steadfast companion, then overcome all threats of danger and walk with him content and mindful. But if one finds no worthy friend, no virtuous, steadfast companion, then as a king leaves his conquered realm, walk like a tusker in the woods alone. Better it is to walk alone than there is no companionship with fools. Walk alone and do no evil, at ease like a tusker in the woods. And then he got up and left. Now, this upset the people of Kosambi very much. And they started blaming the monks for making the Buddha go away when he was planning on spending 3 months there. And they stopped feeding the monks. And the monks, not getting any food, became kind of distressed by that. And they stopped fighting, realizing what foolish persons they actually were. They were fighting over a trivial rule of Vinaya. And they had a hard 3 months, because when they stopped fighting, some of the people said, okay, we'll start giving you food again, but a lot of them didn't. So they had their veins popping out and their eyes sunken in their head because they were getting very little food because of their acts and their actions. Then, having uttered these stanzas, while standing, the Blessed One went to a village. On that occasion, the Venerable Bhagu was living at the village. When the Venerable Bhagu saw the Blessed One coming in the distance, he prepared a seat and set out water for washing the feet. The Blessed One sat down at a seat made ready and washed his feet. The Venerable Bhagu paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side. The Blessed One said to him, I hope you're keeping well, monk. I hope you're comfortable. I hope you're not having any trouble getting alms food. I am keeping well, Blessed One. I am comfortable, and I'm not having any trouble getting alms food. Then the Blessed One instructed, urged, roused, and gladdened the Venerable Bhagu on a talk on the Dhamma, after which he rose from his seat and went to the eastern bamboo park. Now on that occasion, the Venerable Aniruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbila were living at the eastern bamboo park. The park keeper saw the Blessed One coming in the distance and told him, do not enter this park, recluse. There are 3 clansmen here seeking their own good. Do not disturb them. The Venerable Aniruddha heard the park keeper speaking to the Blessed One and told him, friend park keeper, do not keep the Blessed One out. It is our teacher, the Blessed One, who has come. Then the Venerable Aniruddha went to the Venerable Nandiya and the Venerable Kimbila and said, come out, Venerable Sirs, come out. Our teacher, the Blessed One, has come. Then all 3 went to meet the Blessed One. One took his bowl and outer robe. His bowl was made out of crystal. It's not an easy thing to carry around. One prepared a seat and one set out washing water for washing the feet. The Blessed One sat down on the seat made ready and washed his feet. Then these three venerable ones paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side, and the Blessed One said to them, "I hope you're keeping well. I hope you're comfortable. I hope you're not having any trouble getting alms food." "We are keeping well, Blessed One. We are comfortable, and we're not having any trouble getting alms food. I hope, Anuruddha, that you're all living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." "Surely, Venerable Sir, we're living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." "But Anuruddha, how do you live thus?" "Venerable Sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me, that I'm living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I consider why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, Venerable Sir, but one in mind." The Venerable Nandiya and the Venerable Kambila each spoke likewise, adding, "That is how, Venerable Sir, we're living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." Good Anuruddha, I hope you all abide diligent, ardent, and resolute." That means he hopes that they're practicing some meditation. "Surely, Venerable Sir, we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. But Anuruddha, how do you abide thus?" "Venerable Sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts out the refuge bucket in its place. Whichever of us returns last, eats any food that's left over if he wishes, otherwise he throws the food away." When I was in Burma, I was in a very, very poor section of Burma. And they would rather give food to me than eat themselves. That's how devout they really were. But I always came back to the monastery with enough food for 4 or 5 monks. So when I got done, instead of throwing the food away, I would take the food and put it on a tray, and then I took it back down to the village and gave it to the families that were hungry. And I was criticized very heavily for that, because monks aren't supposed to do that. But I can't see wasting food, especially when they were so poor. I mean, they were so poor that sometimes they could give me one peanut or one potato chip. That's all they had to give. And I had plenty of food. I had to have somebody help carry the food for me. That's how much food I was getting. So I always would give it back. And sometimes some people would come to the monastery that were fairly wealthy, and they would leave donations and that sort of thing. So I put everything that I got, I didn't need it, so just gave it away. One of the problems in Asia that I see is the Asians are taught to put monks up on a pedestal. And I don't like being on a pedestal. They give them so much respect and give them as much as they possibly can all the time. And they actually do worship the monks. Whether the monks are good monks or bad monks, it doesn't matter. But as I said, I don't like being on a pedestal. So I try to discourage that. Every time I would walk any place, people would come and start bowing to me, even if it was raining and they were in a puddle. They would kneel down and put their head in the water and bow. And I tried to get them to stop doing that, because that's external shows of goodness. That's all good and well. But what I try to teach people to do is be the example of keeping your precepts. And this is an important part of the practice that's not talked about very much. And that's sad. Because if you break your precepts and you try to meditate, it makes you very restless because you've broken precepts. You keep your precepts, your progress is going to be very fast. I have students in Asia that the first time they come to a retreat, they keep their precepts very well. By the second day, they're progressing very, very quickly. And they're ideal students. A lot of people ask me, how do I become a teacher? What do I have to do to be a teacher? What do I have to learn? Keep your precepts. Be the example. Show people, especially with words. Let go of gossip. Let go of white lies. You become much more trustworthy when you use speech that doesn't hedge on things. You're not trying to fool somebody with your speech. You be honest. You don't have wrong sexual activity, because that causes problems not only for you, but everybody else around you. You don't steal, you don't take things that aren't given, and you don't harm other beings. Now, these are pretty easy precepts to keep, but the nature of being a human being and being around other human beings is to not take this kind of stuff so seriously. And it really needs to be taken seriously. Yeah, but that's morality. That was pushed at me with all the Christian stuff when I was growing up, and I hated that stuff. Well, there's a reason for doing it. If you want to have a pure mind, you don't break the precepts. You don't cause yourself problems. I've had students that I've had for years and years and years. When they get off retreat, they come and tell me, now I can go back to being the way I was. Well, what are you taking a retreat with me for? I'm showing you how to change and not be the same way you were. How to be a more happy person, more uplifted. Not trying to deceive the world so you have advantage. The closer you keep the precepts, the less anxiety, depression, fear, the less you will have these things. And life starts to become very magical. Your mind tends towards the wholesome. And when it tends towards the wholesome, wholesome things start happening for you. This is to your benefit. So the more you can keep the precepts without breaking them, the easier your meditation becomes. And the faster your progress is in the meditation. So, the more you can practice your generosity, and keep your precepts, the easier your sitting is going to be. A lot of people have strange ideas about generosity, and they teach meditation and say, well, you should be giving to the teacher because he's giving so much back to you. That's not real generosity, that's coercion. Real generosity is something that I didn't see very much today. And that is, take a guess, smiling. I didn't see a whole lot of that today. You're being too serious. You need to have a light mind. And the way you have a light mind is by practicing your smiling. And when you're smiling and happy, give it away. Give it to other people. That's how you practice your generosity. And remember when you did those kind of things, and be happy and rejoice in yourself because you were able to give that. You were able to help somebody else be happy. That's something that's not encouraged in this country. Greed and hatred is the thing that's encouraged in this country. So, practice your generosity at every chance you can get. Say something that makes somebody else happy. Do something that helps them to be happy. And the more you can do that, the more magical life becomes. This is about change. It's about changing your old habits from worry, anxiety, whatever hindrance arises. Now, this particular sutta, as I get into it, starts talking more and more about the different 10 different kinds of upakalesa. Kalesa means hindrance. Upa means 10. The 10 hindrances. So, This is how to overcome these hindrances. And the best way to do that, practice the six R's. Not only while you're sitting, but all of the time. An awful lot of people take the word craving as a it's just desire. And they don't understand that craving is the cause of suffering. Now, I've gone to a lot of teachers in Asia, big teachers, teachers that are highly respected by masses of people. And I ask them what craving is. Oh, it's desire. Okay. How do you recognize craving when it arises? Well, when you desire something, when you want something. Well, that's not a good answer. That's just a general idea. What is craving? Craving is the I like it, I don't like it mind. This is very subtle stuff that I'm starting to show you. It's not going to be big, gross movements of mind's attention. It's not going to be this massive headache that you get when craving comes up. It comes up and it's a very subtle feeling. And the definition of craving is the I like it, I don't like it mind. How do you let go of that? By relaxing that tightness caused by the disturbance in your mind. What's a disturbance? Anything that takes you away from staying with your object of meditation. For some reason, I have a tendency to draw a lot of engineers to the meditation, and engineers train themselves to think and analyze. And that's a hindrance. This is not about thinking, this is about letting it go and having a clear mind. The more you get caught in your thinking, the more you're caught in restlessness. And the harder the meditation becomes. But when you use the six R's and stop insisting on trying to figure this feeling out and why is that feeling there, and what caused that feeling to arise? We don't care about any of that in Buddhism. Actually, there was some teachers that I had that I was meditating with, and they said, that's the Western disease. Why did that happen? It doesn't matter why it happens. That's psychology. They're always looking for why. But in Buddhism, we don't care about why. We want you to see how this process works. Why does it work that way? Because conditions are right. We don't care. How does this work? A feeling comes up. I like it. It's pleasant. I don't like it. It's painful. How did that perception arise? It is craving. If it's a painful feeling, my mind closes down on it. If it's a pleasant feeling, my mind closes down on it. Because I like it or I dislike it. Almost all of the Buddhist teachers these days, they talk about clinging being the cause of suffering. And that's where your false idea and a personal self is fed. But it doesn't start at clinging. It starts at craving. That's the very beginning of starting to take this feeling personally, that craving comes up, that tightness in your mind. And then you start with your ideas and your opinions and your concepts and your stories. We don't care about the content of the thoughts. Now, when you start looking at the good qualities of the Dhamma, the second one is that the Dhamma is immediately effective. Immediately effective. What does that mean? It means as soon as you notice that your mind is distracted, you let go of the distraction. You don't keep your attention on it. You don't get caught up in your nonsense thinking about it or analyzing it, or trying to make it what you want it to be and get caught up in your imagination. We don't get caught up in that. We immediately let it be the way it is and relax the tightness caused by that distraction. Then we bring up something wholesome. We bring up a smile. It's easy. Right? It's simple. Then why am I looking at people that aren't smiling? Keep the smile on your face. Keep the smile in your mind. When you're smiling, your mind is uplifted. It tends towards the wholesome. That means you're letting go of old past hindrances or breaking of precepts in the past. It doesn't even have to be in this lifetime. It can be in another lifetime that it arises. Who cares? We don't care why it arises. What do you do with it right now? You have a smiling mind. You bring that smiling, pure mind back to your object of meditation. You'll start to stay on your object of meditation for longer and longer periods of time. And your distractions will be much easier to catch if you don't take them as yours personally and get wrapped up in, oh, I remember when I had something like this before, and this is what happened, and that's what happened. All of those kind of thinkings are distractions. They're taking you away from staying on your object of meditation. You don't need to analyze anything. You don't need to think things. Let go of that. Now, this is immediately effective because when you're practicing looking at the truth, you're not getting involved in trying to analyze the truth or trying to make the truth different than it is, or try to change the truth in one way or another. You're seeing the truth of there is a distraction and you let it be. And immediately you relax. So now you're not caught by that distraction anymore. And then immediately you smile, and immediately you come back to your object of meditation. That's why this is a flow. You're not trying to memorize what the six R's are. You're doing what the six R's say to do. And it's simple. The problem is, craving is not particularly strong, but it is particularly persistent. It keeps coming up over and over again. If you don't have a practice where you can recognize that your mind is distracted, you let it be without getting involved in the story of it, and you relax. When you do this, you are purifying your mind. That's what Nibbana is. You're letting go of that fire of past actions that you've been holding on to. Your guilty feeling because I told Mom a lie when I was 5 years old. You don't remember it anymore. But some people try to figure out, why did that come up? Why doesn't matter. We don't care about why. Seeing how this process works, that's what Buddhism is about. And it is very effective. It does work very well. The more you bring up a wholesome object and hold to that, the more it will start to arise by itself. What you think and ponder on, that's the inclination of your mind. You think and ponder on worry, on anxiety, on dislike, on anger, then your mind is going to tend towards that. And it's going to keep coming up over and over again. Why? Habitual tendency. So when you start practicing smiling, your mindfulness gets sharper. And as you do that more and more and more, your mind is going to tend to do that more and more. Somebody told me one time, he wasn't much of a meditator, he was more of a thinker, that Buddhism is about letting go of all habits. And that's not true. Well, if you have a habit, you're attached to it. That's not true. You're not attached to anything when you use the six R's. You're just observing. And you're observing how mind becomes lighter and more alert. And when you start to go deep in your meditation, you'll get to a place where lust and hatred become much less than they ever were before. Doesn't mean you're not going to get caught by them occasionally. But it becomes much less. You don't get caught for as long. You start seeing that you're causing yourself pain. And you start letting go of that. As you go even deeper, lust and hatred won't even arise in your mind. Now think about that. What a nice state that is. And it's possible. It's possible on this retreat that it can happen for you. But you can't add anything, you can't subtract anything, just follow the six R's. Let go of your trying to analyze and think, well, what does it say about this in the suttas? We don't care. Let go of all of that thinking. I'm showing you something that is very unique. Because there are some books and commentaries that have divided jhana practice and insight practice. And they're not the same. You can't do them at the same time. Well, but you can do them at the same time, and I'm showing you how to do them at the same time. The jhana practice, if it does not have the relaxed step in it, is going to lead you off of the Buddha's path. And I'm not saying it's bad. You can do all kinds of good meditation and have deep concentration. And that's not bad. It just doesn't lead to the same end result. And what I'm most interested in is the end result where you go through real personality change. And you become happier. You have more balance in your mind. And then you start watching how when you have a more wholesome mind, good things start happening and they just kind of pop up in front of you. And it's wonderful. That's what getting rid of the hindrances is all about. So that you can have a more happy life right here, right now. And you can do it on this retreat. The last time I gave a retreat here, there was somebody that gave up their lust and hatred. No more. I get a word from him every now and then, and he's telling me how wonderful life is and how much he's having fun with other people. He was kind of a recluse before. And now he's having fun. And he's not worrying about, oh, what am I going to do? This problem came up. How can I solve that? They don't worry. He doesn't worry about that. He doesn't indulge in worry. He doesn't indulge in anxiety. He doesn't indulge in overanalyzing. He's in the present. And his mind has balance. He still has ups and downs. They're going to be there. But what does he do with them? He doesn't get caught up in trying to figure out how to change something. He does what's necessary to be done and waits and sees what the outcome is going to be, not worrying about it. The society that we live in today in America is really kind of screwed up. And everybody knows that. And you spend time reading the newspaper. Why? Oh, I have to know what's happening in the news. No, you don't. You don't need the newspaper. You don't need to get upset when you see something in the news that's upsetting. I had one student that she read 4 newspapers a day. I said, why in the world do you do that? Well, I have to read all these different opinions. and see what's happening in the world. And I said, do you have any opinions on your own? Do you have to read somebody else's opinion to make up your mind whether you're right or not? And I started making fun of her as the news lady. And finally she got the idea and she stopped reading the newspaper and became much happier because of it. Yeah, but this plane got blown up in the Indian Ocean. Does that affect you here and now one way or the other by knowing that or not knowing it? Anything that's big and important, other people are going to tell you about. You don't have to read it every day and make yourself upset because of it. Politics. Yeah. She also wore only browns, grays, and blacks in her clothes. And I said, how do you see the world? Is everything brown or gray or black to you? Well, yeah, it's pretty much white and black. After I started showing her this and how to do the meditation, I suggested that she go to the store and buy some color. And at the end of the retreat, she started saying, you know, I look out and I'm seeing greens and yellows and purples. Everything had changed from grays to color, and she's seeing the world the way it actually is. Changing an old habit, an old way of looking at things, into a wholesome, fun way of looking at things. Taking joy in seeing color and how wonderful it truly is. Do you need to read that in the newspaper so you can have an opinion of whether that's really good or not? So keeping your precepts makes your mind more alive, more aware. And the longer you keep the precepts, the more alive you become. I had one student in Malaysia. He said, okay, I'm going to keep the precepts. How long do I have to do that? And I said, well, we'll start at 100 years and go up from there. Don't break your precepts. And it was amazing the change that he went through when he started keeping the precepts. He started to develop his laugh, and he started developing an uplifted mind, and he started seeing that other people liked him too. Oh, it was amazing what he went through. When you learn how to recognize craving and let it be, now you're seeing with a mind that's clear, that isn't distracted. You're seeing things the way they actually are. And the personality change that you go through with this practice is real. It's not just, yeah, I did a retreat and I was real happy for 2 or 3 days, and after that I went back to the way I was. No. When you start seeing for yourself how this stuff works, and you stop taking it personally, and you start relaxing into things, you're starting to affect the world around you in a positive way. You're affecting the world around you because you're not holding on to a tight view of the way you think the world should be. I work a lot with Chinese in different countries. And this one Chinese man, he came to a retreat. And he said, "I have so much problem with my wife. She's always doing things that annoy me. What can I do about that?" And I said, "If you want her to change, you have to change. By your tight view of her always being this way, you're making her be that way. When you start seeing good qualities in her and in yourself and start appreciating that, then she's going to stop doing the things that annoy you. You affect the world around you. You don't really understand how powerful mind is when you get caught up in your fears and anxieties and all of this kind of thing. There's real freedom in letting go of wanting to control. There's real freedom in that. There's a lot of students that they try to micromanage everything that they do, and they cause not only suffering in themselves, they cause it in other people too. Because you always got somebody looking over your shoulder not being satisfied. What is that? How are you affecting the world around you? When you start using the six R's and letting go of these old habitual tendencies, you're letting the world become more wholesome, more uplifted, more happy. Now, these hindrances, these things that block our progress, they're our teacher. Why? Because it keeps happening over and over and over again until you learn to recognize it, release it, relax, smile, return to something wholesome. Keep with that wholesomeness all the time. With gratitude, learning how to appreciate little things instead of being critical of little things. Then you start affecting your family members, and then you start affecting your friends, and then you start affecting people all the way around you. Why? Because your mind's uplifted. That's what the Buddha's practice is. Learning how to recognize these hindrances when they arise, these old habitual tendencies, these old ways of thinking that cause so much problem, that takes a little tiny problem and turns it into a huge problem that there's no way around. So now I get to worry about it. Last year I went to Indonesia, and the first day I got to Indonesia I started having problems with my appendix. There was 100 people that showed up at the house that I was staying at, all bringing food. I mean, there was so much food, it was unbelievable. And I started feeling bad, and I told someone that I think I'm having some appendicitis, and I got to get this checked out. So after a couple hours, they found a hospital that was very good doctors and all of this kind of thing. And I went and had an MRI. And the doctor comes and he starts talking to me, you know, this, if you have appendicitis, this is really serious. It could be all kinds of problems, and it could, you can be really in bad shape for a long time. And I said, okay, fine. He said, aren't you worried about it? I said, you're a good doctor, right? He said, yeah, I've done this hundreds of times. Then I don't have to worry about it. You can worry about it for me. So it turned out that I did have appendicitis, and the next day at 11 o'clock I went into surgery, and I wound up spending the night in the hospital. And the next day the doctor comes and he says, you have any pain? No, I don't have any pain. There's a little soreness when they drilled a hole in my side. And it's nothing. Well, you got to be really careful. You should really start taking good care of yourself. You can get infection. You can have all these problems. I said, you give me medicine? Yeah. Does it work? Yeah. Okay. And he said, does anything bother you? And I said, why should it? Well, this is a major problem. No, it's not my problem, it's yours. You're taking care of me. I trust you. So that the day after the operation, I left. Day after that, I went to Bali. And people are going, oh, you poor dear, I'm so worried about you. I didn't have any problems. It was taken care of. And they found a doctor, and he was coming every day to check and make sure I wasn't getting any infection or anything like that. And after 4 days, the scabs went away. There was no more open wounds. Went away. He comes the next day, he said, well, you're healed already. I said, yeah, okay. I got to go to work. You know, it's time for me to give a retreat. It didn't bother me at all. Now, I could have worried about that. I could have made myself a lot sicker than I was. But why? 6R. Well, there's some fear there. He's going to have to dig into my body and take something out. 6R. No problem. Your mind is a really amazing tool, but you have to use it in the correct way. So, we'll get back to the sutta. Surely, venerable sir, we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. But Anarut, how do you abide thus? Venerable sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts out the refuge bucket, whichever of us returns last, eats any food left over, if he wishes, otherwise he gets rid of it. He then puts away the refuge bucket after washing it and sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that pots of water for drinking and washing or the latrine are low or empty, takes care of them. If they're too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands, but because of that, they don't break out into speech. Noble silence even then. But every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing Dhamma. That is how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. Good, Aniruddha, but while you abide diligent, ardent, and resolute, have you attained any superhuman states, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of noble ones, a comfortable abiding? He's saying, have you attained any jhanas? That's what he's asking. Venerable sir, as we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute, we perceive both radiance and the object of meditation. Soon afterwards, the radiance and object of meditation disappear, but we have not discovered the cause for that. You should discover the cause for that, Aniruddha. Before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisatta, I too perceived both radiance and objects of meditation. Soon afterwards, the radiance and object of meditation disappeared. I thought, what is the cause and condition? Why the radiance and object of meditation have disappeared? Then I considered thus. Doubt arose in me, and because of doubt, there was the concentration, your object of meditation fell away. When your object of meditation fell away, the radiance disappeared. I shall so act that doubt will not arise in me again. Now, the thing with this, what I just read, is this question: when you have a persistent hindrance coming up, you feel very restless, or you have a lot of sloth and torpor, this question is, what is the cause and condition why this radiance and object of meditation have disappeared? You ask yourself the question, why am I having so much restlessness? You just ask it one time and then let it go and go back to doing your meditation. The answer will come. You're trying too hard. You're trying to force something. You had a good meditation before, and now you're trying to make it like the other good meditation was. You're trying to achieve something. So you get restless. There was a lady that I was teaching meditation to that she could get into the jhana fairly easily. And she heard me give a talk on making a determination to have things happen the way you want. She started making a determination, I want to get into jhana. And she came to me after she'd done this for a little while and she said, I get so restless now. I know what jhana is, I know how to get into it, but I can't get into it anymore. I'm just restless. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, well, before I sit, I tell myself, I want this jhana to happen. And I said, well, you're using a determination in the wrong way. What's happening is you're putting an expectation of what you want to see happen in the future happen when you want it to happen. And when you start sitting, it doesn't happen immediately, so you try harder. And when you try harder, you get more restless. And as you try, you go, oh, I must not be putting enough energy into this. I need to try a little bit harder. And you get even more restless. It'll drive you crazy. Some people come in and they tell me, I've had such a lousy day today. I was restless all day. Well, why were you restless? Well, every time I tried the 6 hours, sometimes I couldn't even get done with the 6 hours before my mind got distracted. Ah, okay. You're trying to do too much. You're trying too hard. You're trying to put in the wrong kind of effort. You only 6 hours when your mind is distracted away from your object of meditation. You can be sitting with your object of meditation and thoughts will come through. You don't have to 6 hours those. Just ignore those. Stay with your object of meditation. Those thoughts will fade away by themselves. So what were they doing? They were trying to 6R every thought that came up. And that's not part of the instruction. And they cause themselves to have a lot of suffering. One of the things in this particular sutta talks about longing. I want to be peaceful and calm. That very desire is a kind of determination that will make your mind restless. And always when you feel restless, the way to overcome that is not by trying to make it stop, by backing off. That's how you get rid of it. Now, when I give you instructions in the kind of wishes you make for your spiritual friend, I always include the wish for peace and calm. When you get restless, bring up that wish in your practice. Feel peace and calm. Bring that peace and calm into your heart. Feel that. Put your friend right in the middle of that peace and calm. Radiate that feeling. The restlessness will go away. That's one of the instructions that it says in one of the other books. And how to overcome restlessness. How to overcome sloth and torpor. Take more interest in your object of meditation, in your friend, whatever your object happens to be. More interest. And you have to 6R. Well, I'm already sleepy, why do I have to relax? How does sloth and torpor arise? What happens first? What happens after that? What am I telling you? I'm telling you, you need to sharpen your mindfulness. Remember the definition? Remembering to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another? What happens first? What happens after that? As you take more attention on how this process works, the sloth and torpor will fade away by itself. And you have to siksar it, because it did pull your attention away from your object of meditation. For a lot of people that are successful in the meditation, they want it to happen again. The fastest way to not make it happen, the fastest way to get real restless and get caught up in your thoughts and your opinions and your desires and all of these kind of things. And you come to me and you say, you know, my mind is just not calming down. Didn't I always laugh with that? Yeah, of course it is. You want something to happen in a particular way? Do you know what's going to happen in 5 minutes? Why try to make something happen in 5 minutes? Putting in the wrong kind of energy, the wrong kind of effort. When you see you're doing that, you need to back off. Don't try so hard. Have a sense of humor about yourself. Laugh with yourself, for there my mind's going crazy again. And you'll see, oh, it's only this, I want it to happen. I try so hard. Well, don't stop trying so hard. As a matter of fact, don't try at all. Either do it or don't do it. There is no try. If you have a try, that means you're leaving yourself open to fail. So don't try to do anything. Make up your mind whether you're going to do it or not. In Indonesia, I start some retreats by telling them certain words that I don't want them to use. I don't want to hear them. And try is one of those things. But is another one of those things. Bored is another one of those things. I don't want to hear about that. If you're bored, you don't have any mindfulness. If you don't have mindfulness, it's a distraction. It's a problem. How do you overcome these problems? By asking yourself, what is the cause? Why is this happening? When I was working at a meditation center, I was kind of a handyman for the house that was falling apart. And I was building different things, and I was real active. And the teacher came to me and he said, this man wants to do a meditation retreat. I don't want him to do it alone. Why don't you do the retreat with him? And I'm thinking, well, I'm at a meditation center. Okay, I'll do the retreat. But after the second or third day, I'm getting very restless. And I'm not prone to restlessness so much. And I'm thinking, boy, this is really strange. You know, I've done retreats before. I don't know, I never have restlessness. My mind tends more towards sleepiness and dullness. Why am I restless? I just asked that question to myself. Went back, started doing the meditation again. The answer came, and it's my intuition said, you don't really want to be doing this. You want to be fixing these other things that need, they're falling apart. And as soon as I saw that, I went, yeah, that's right. And as I recognized that's what the problem was, I could let it go. No, I'd rather be here meditating. That's fine. So the restlessness went away. I didn't have to try to control it. I had to let go of my attachment to other things. Because while I was doing the meditation, I'd see something and, oh, that window needs to be fixed. Oh, I got to make sure that I remember to do this or that. And that's what I was doing. I wasn't really meditating. I was thinking. And it made me restless. That doesn't speak well for me now. I don't get so restless. That means I'm not thinking. But this is the question that you need to ask yourself. If you have a persistent hindrance that keeps coming back over and over again, there is an attachment there. Find out what it is. Ask yourself just one time. You don't have to keep repeating, why is this happening? Why is this happening? No, no, no. Just one time. Why is this happening? Let your intuition come and tell you. Develop your intuition. The only way you can develop your intuition is with a quiet mind, because it's a quiet voice. If you're busy thinking and worrying and anxiety and fluttering around from one thing to another with your mind, analyzing this and doing that, intuition comes in and you don't pay attention to it. During a retreat, you learn to develop the ability to hear your intuition. And when you hear your intuition, you follow its guidance. Yeah, that's true. Let it go. Now I see what that problem is. Remember that hindrances are your teachers. They keep coming up over and over again because you're taking it personally, because you're attached to it. When you start using the six R's, your mind, right after you use the six R's, your mind is quiet. You don't have any thoughts in your mind at that time. You have an observant mind. You have a mind that's radiant. You have a mind that's pure. So you bring that to your wholesome. You bring that to your smile and your object of meditation. That's how you truly have personality development. One of the disadvantages of doing one-pointed concentration, which is almost everybody else's teaching meditation is talking about one-pointed concentration. The disadvantage is the power of the concentration suppresses your hindrances. And your hindrances are where your attachments are. And that's where your guilty feeling for doing something that caused pain to somebody else, that's where these kind of things are stored, in your hindrances. And they're going to keep coming up until you finally recognize, oh, I don't need to do that anymore. I don't need to get caught up in the story and the anxiety and the dislike and the attachment. You don't have to do that anymore. You six are it. Let it be. That stuff that happened in the past, well, it's gone. You can't do anything to change it right now, but you can let it go, and that's what needs to happen. Relax that tightness caused by that hindrance. And when you let go of that guilty feeling for breaking a precept, your mind becomes more happy naturally. You feel relief when you let go of it. You'll have some joy coming up by itself. Nice, happy feeling. After the joy fades away, your mind will become very nice and tranquil. And you'll feel more comfortable in your body and in your mind than you ever felt before. And your mind just stays with that, your object of meditation. I just described to you the first jhana. Amazing, isn't it? There's too many people that are doing meditation that make too big a deal out of the jhanas. I had this one person that I was teaching in Korea. I've been meditating for 10 years. I know what I'm doing. And she ran across what I was teaching, which means she had to start all over again. And she started having a lot of hindrances. And I was getting her finally to start letting go after a little while, and she got this big burst of self-importance. When I was talking about a jhana, she said, "I know what jhanas are. I have the fourth jhana." Like I was supposed to be impressed with it. And I said, "So? You've done this practice for 10 years. You haven't gone through any personality change. You still have the same hindrances coming up over and over again. What's the sense of your meditation? Why are you being attached to that? When you see that these hindrances, when you let them go, you start going deeper and deeper into a quiet mind, a more happy mind, a more uplifted mind. Why do you want to continue on the classic Einstein knew everything that they're talking about now? Do the same thing over and over and expect a different result? That's what people that are doing one point of concentration are doing. And because of that, they're saying, well, there's no such a thing as Nibbana anymore. It's lost. And I'm here to tell you that's not true. If people would let go of their attachment of I know the right way and teach yourself what the hindrances are and how to let go of the hindrances, if you would add that extra step of relax into the practice, you would start going through these personality developments. You would start going through these changes. And you would be able to experience Nibbana. As I said, I'm used to people that follow the directions closely. They don't add anything. Well, I'm going to do this meditation now because I don't feel like doing the other one. If you don't do that, your progress is going to be fast. And I am used to having a lot of people on my retreats be very successful. But you have to follow the directions I'm giving you. And they're not my directions. This is from the Buddha. This is learning how hindrances can be let go of. So you can have more and more clarity of mind. Letting go of the idea that you're so smart, you know, and nobody else does. You have to let go of all that nonsense kind of thinking. I run across some of the hardest, the two hardest groups of people to teach. Engineers and Tibetans. People that practice Tibetan meditation, they always come at me and say, well, the meditation that we teach in Tibet with this guru or whoever he is, it's almost the same as what you're teaching. Well, almost only counts in horseshoes. There's no such a thing as almost. It's almost the same thing. No, it's not almost the same thing, because the end result is decidedly different. So you have to let go of the almosts. Well, but what they said is really good. Fine. That's, they can say a lot of really good things. But how is your practice going? Are you more happy? Are you more uplifted? Are you more clear than you've ever been before? When you're doing that different kind of practice? Well, no. Well, try something new. A lot of the Tibetans, they won't even talk about Nibbana because they don't know what the experience is like. They haven't been taught what the experience is like. And I'm not criticizing them. A lot of the things that they do is very, very good. It's just, what is the end result? So the more we can let go of all of our past experiences and just let them be, and don't try to incorporate, my practice was pretty good when I did this, I think I'm going to try this now. No, don't do that. Just use the six R's. That's what the Buddha said. Yeah, but I have this teacher and he's Buddhist. Well, a lot of teachers are influenced in the wrong way. They're not influenced by going back to the suttas and finding out what the Buddha actually said. They're influenced by what they were taught that was freelance teaching. It wasn't the actual teaching of the Buddha. They might say some of, well, the Buddha said this. But that might not necessarily be true. Now, I am going to be reading more from the sutta. I just wanted to get to this one thing. The learning how to ask a question of yourself so you can see why you're caught in one way or another. Why do I have this hindrance coming up? It always comes up. Well, ask yourself the question, why? The answer will come, and then adjust accordingly. Or it can take years to have progress in your meditation by not paying attention to that, by not wanting to change. And the whole point of coming to Buddhism is you've tried a lot of different things to help overcome the suffering. That's why people come to Buddhism, because they're suffering and they want a way out. And the Buddha offered a way out. And it's pretty simple and it's pretty easy. But it gets sometimes confused when, like I was seeing in some of the magazines, advertisement for Muslim Buddhism. Come and practice our Muslim Buddhism or our Christian Buddhism. Well, why don't we try just practicing what the Buddha said and not add this other stuff? Well, is it okay if I pray to Jesus? I don't care what you do, not on the retreat. Just do the 6 hours and you'll see. Don't try adding other things. I had this one lady, she insisted that she chant every morning. She asked permission if I said, can I chant every morning? I said, no. That's going to confuse your practice. Don't do that. That's just like talking. Don't do that. It's going to bother your practice. So she decided that she was going to chant anyway. And I walked into her room while she was chanting and I said, do you want to leave? Oh, no, I like your teaching. Okay, follow what I said. Don't chant. Or you can leave. I don't care. Follow the practice the way it's being taught. You will learn a lot. And it will make your life more uplifting and happy. But don't believe me. I don't want you to believe a word that I say. Do it. See for yourself whether it's right or not. So that didn't get any response, so I guess we'll... Share some merit. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we have thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of us. May they long protect the Buddhist dispensations. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.